Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Timber Living Log Cabins. For your perfect workspace, living space or hideaway, timberliving.ie. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Timber Living Log Cabins. Open your mind to a new way of living. timberliving.ie.
Good morning, you're very welcome to the show. We look at the papers first, and there are, of course, four pictures on the front of nearly all the papers, and they are Nicole Murphy, aged 18, and Zoe Coffey, also aged 18, and Grace McSweeney, also aged 18, and Grace's brother Luke McSweeney, aged 24. The front of the Mail says, "Our grief is unbearable," is their headline. I think they're quoting Michael O'Loughlin, the principal of Presentation College, where Zoe and Grace went to school. The Sunday Times, "The whole nation mourns four young lives cut short." The Sunday Independent, "We are devastated. No words can give comfort." And that is Father Michael Toomey, who spoke so affectingly to us yesterday morning, who has been comforting the families since Friday night. The Irish Sun on Sunday, "The nation mourns for them, heartbreak as victims named." The Sunday World, "A nation's tears." The Mirror, "A cloud of sadness, devastation after four killed in Leaving Cert horror crash." And the Business Post goes with a budget story, "O'Brien pushes landlord tax cuts and developer backstop." And it seems that the budget will be supporting renters, landlords, developers. The government is going to be supporting every side of it. There's an extraordinary kind of piece of information in that piece, which I think we kind of half knew anyway. So the Croí Cónaithe scheme, which was offering nearly 150,000 to developers to make up the price between the cost of building something and how much you might get for selling it. And we all thought, big bailout for developers, handing them out 150 grand, it's crazy. Out of a target of 5,000, only 1,100 eligible homes have been identified, because 150 grand is apparently not sufficient to bridge the gap between what it costs to build an apartment and what it costs to sell it. It's extraordinary. Our panel this morning, Ciara Phelan is a political correspondent with the Irish Examiner. Kate O'Connell is a pharmacist and a former Fine Gael TD. Carl Dieter is a financial analyst. And Professor Gary Murphy is from the School of Law and Government at DCU. Good morning, everyone.
Morning, Brendan.
Look, Kate, we'll start with that awful tragedy in Clonmel. I think it has struck the whole country, hasn't it?
It has indeed, and I'm familiar actually with the road in question. It's a desperate road, and it's just everyone's worst nightmare. It takes the edge off the whole conversation about grade inflation and places and accommodation. I think every family in Ireland is just shocked at the devastation. And the four beautiful young people, three lovely young women heading off in their lives, and the tragedy brought upon the community. But I think, you know, when you see teachers and priests and those pillars of the community coming out and always saying the words that we all want to hear, I suppose you get to think about the fabric of society and how important those people are in our society when tragedy strikes. And I think the thoughts and prayers of the entire nation are with the families down there today. It's just heartbreaking.
Yeah. And just on what you say about the fabric of society, I think a lot of people were struck by that guard, his name escapes me now, who spoke last night. And again, you think about what he mentioned it, what those guards came on and what all those first responders were greeted with there.
And teachers embracing themselves for the emotional fallout and the psychological fallout. It's just desperate. There really are no words.
Yeah, yeah. Ciara, I suppose the fact that it occurred at a time that is a kind of a collective moment anyway in the Irish psyche, the whole Leaving Cert results has kind of gave it more power for people as well, maybe.
Yeah, absolutely. And like Kate has touched on it, it really puts into perspective the importance of life. And we've discussed all week about grade inflation and Norma Foley being criticised for the decisions she's made. You see children delighted with the results that they've received. But then you look at this, the family of those affected, the friends, the community, the first responders, the other students that were on their way to celebrate when the bus had to turn back because they learned that those that were to join them on the bus would no longer be seeing them again. And it just really puts into perspective, you know, the stress and pressure that, you know, students and perhaps sometimes their parents put on themselves when it comes to the leaving cert. And then you have to ask yourself sometimes for what really when something so drastic and tragic like this happens.
Yeah. I became a father to two teenagers yesterday. The second one became a teenager, you know, and the second one will probably be with us forever. And it's the thing we say, will Mary, you'll always be with us. And I found myself thinking in the last 24 hours, is that such a bad thing? She'll probably never get 7 A's in her leaving cert or whatever. Mm-hmm. But you know what? Perspective is the word, isn't it, Gary?
Oh, very much so, Brendan. I've had three children go through leaving cert, and it is certainly a rite of passage. And when we greet our incoming first years now in the next couple of weeks, and I'm very conscious that there are families who won't be waving their children off at university or to apprenticeships or whatever these young people's plans were. And of course, this is the second tragedy on our roads of young people. We had the two girls in Monaghan a few weeks back going to their debs. So it's just, you know, it's horrendous. I think the tabloids have it right, as they often do this morning. The Nation mourns. I mean, when the news came in on Friday night, I was just at home and, you know, you would just be numb. And I think the Nation is still numb, you know, 48 hours on.
Yeah. Carl?
Yeah, I mean, it's awful news, and I agree with everything that everyone has said so far. And I can't adequately even try to imagine what their families and loved ones are going through. I mean, if you have kids, do you ever see them fall and you get that kind of that moment where your heart goes in your chest, or they do get hurt, or you get a call from school and like they've hurt themselves and you suddenly go into this panic feeling? Imagine getting that call. I mean, that has to be the worst thing that you could ever expect as a parent. And in particular, the McSweeney family, two of their kids, I just can't adequately even articulate what I'm trying to say, other than to extend my deepest condolences to all of those involved.
Yeah, and look, I think that really is all that there is to say, and you've all said it all there. So we will move on. There are other things in the papers, and I suppose things that, again, were very important before everybody kind of stopped and thought since Friday night. But look, crime has been a big discussion over the last few weeks, and we were discussing it here yesterday indeed with the former governor of Mountjoy, and one thing I noticed was that he was very much Eddie Mullins is very much on the line of, you know, these people need to be supported, more needs to be done and everything else. A lot of the texts coming in violently disagreeing with that. It does seem like that people are getting quite entrenched on two sides of this, which is we blame society or blame, you know, the perpetrators, and people have various words for them. Kate, you picked an interesting piece in the Sunday Independent by Laura Linnett, Child's Play in Temple Bar. I watch as young boys peddle drugs to tourists.
Yeah, I mean, I'm coming from this issue, I suppose, as a retailer and someone who lives very close to the city centre. And we were in retail for 20 years, nearly the city. My husband's family, 40 years before that, in O'Connell's Pharmacies, right in the city centre. And like, we discussed it over the last few days, how things have changed. Now, what has changed for us is we are now seeing for the first time staff applying to work with us in suburbia because they can't hack the violence in the city centre. And that is, in 20 years of business, I've never had people trying to leave their job solely because what they're encountering on their way to work, during work, and while they're leaving. Now, I do understand that pharmacy may have...
They're a particular magnet for certain type
of
thing, yeah.
So if you're a normal person walking down Grafton Street, it's probably a random attack. If you're the key holder to a pharmacy, you are targeted. And there used to be a bit of respect there in the past where you mightn't do that. But that respect is gone. And it, I suppose, increases in certain areas. retail can't necessarily afford to have security guards on the door. And even in terms of that, what you can do to people and what you might be up for if you grab a lad by the back of the neck as he's fleecing you. So it's a whole different dynamic now. And my fear with reference to the article is there used to be drug dealing 20 years ago, 25 years ago, when I was way younger, going around the city on the boardwalk and parts of O'Connell Street. But now it's open. So it increased and it never stopped.
Is it? Have you seen it?
It's blatantly open.
Yeah.
And it's become acceptable. And if you have a situation where the natural communities move out of certain areas and where there's no retail, you end up with a ghettoisation. You'll never get your city centres back if that happens. And I fear that for O'Connell Street and Grafton Street. And I do think, and
is it connected with the fact that a lot of the services for maybe drug users and are in town, and that is where they tend
to come
into?
Well, it's an easy thing to blame.
And
that conversation is always around injection centres. But you can also see, as a retailer, if you move to the Dundrums or the shopping centres, you essentially end up with a gated community of retail that's a protected environment, but you pull it out of the life of the city. So I blame, you know, the way it's been allowed proliferate in the city centre, the drug dealing, but also the removal of certain things out to the suburbs and the city centres kind of losing the hearts and souls they had for years.
Yeah, and kind of like what has happened in America, that donut hollowing out of the centre.
And they become no-go zones then, and we're not far off that.
Yeah, Ciara, on that, you picked a piece in the Business Post by Jim O'Callaghan, Dublin Needs a Responsible, Accountable Elected Leader with Real Clout.
Yeah, I think the conversation over the last 2 weeks in terms of crime is, you know, what needs to happen, what can help the situation. You know, a lot of people are saying greater visibility with Gardaí on the street with more boots on the ground. But at a political level, you know, Jim is making the point that, you know, nothing really change in the city centre until an elected official is given powers to deal with it. And he uses the example of Amsterdam, and he says the mayor there is given the responsibility of public order, has greater, you know, oversight of the safety in the area. And, you know, he is saying that there's no one in the Oireachtas that is, I know, look, Helen McEntee obviously is Justice Minister, but she's a lot more to deal with, but there's no sole focus on dealing with the crime and issues public order in Dublin alone. And that he is saying that, you know, there needs to be responsibility, someone needs to be held accountable for the successes and failings of what happens in the city centre. And, you know, he says that there's been opposition within the government for quite some time about the possibility of, you know, someone elected given this responsibility because it may show them up. And also there's fears of, you know, maybe a celebrity-like figure being elected to a position, which he says, you know, if you put controls in place, this wouldn't happen. And I think he's made a very good point that would provide that additional level of security and responsibility, and for someone that has to answer questions when we have seen, you know, a focus put on the number of attacks.
Yeah, but as you say, there is we have a Minister for Justice. Gary, we're a small country.
Yeah, I'm a bit skeptical.
It's as if
that,
we need to start kind of having different layers of government. I mean, we're the size of a city, a lot of cities internationally.
We are, and we obviously have a burgeoning population in Dublin, and I think we'll see that in the Electoral Commission's boundary review next week. But I'm always slightly sceptical of crime czars and czars even. You know, we had one in New York, Rudy Giuliani, all those years ago, who I mentioned in my
who
own
who is credited column. With... Okay, obviously there's been a lot of water under the bridge with old Rudy since, but he was credited with cleaning up the city.
Yeah, got results.
I think the structures would have to, like the political structures of putting in place a crime czar, and we know how things go slowly here in Ireland would just take forever. And whatever about showing up, it also could show it down. Like, I mean, what happens if this crime czar isn't successful dealing with the, you know, a miasma of bureaucracy? We have a Minister for Justice. She is responsible. I'm just... And then should we have a crime czar in Limerick and Cork and Galway? I mean, I only had a quick glance at a piece, but I'm not convinced of this
your
idea.
Your own piece today is that the Minister for Justice, that this could be the making of her.
Well, I do reference Giuliani in that piece, not to compare Helen McEntee, who's a former student of mine too. to poor Mr. Giuliani, who's like following Trump, has sort of gone down a rabbit hole that he might never get out of. But certainly crime is in terms of its populist nature, for people are affected by crime and will vote, I think, on potential solutions to crime. There's a very interesting piece by Gary Gannon in the Sunday Mirror today. A Garda plan sounds suspiciously like a PR exercise to me, and he makes what I think is a very good point, that the solution is not 10 million in overtime. It's more bodies on the ground. It's a more visible policing. This goes to Kate's point, I think.
But the 10 million is to give more bodies on the ground, on horses,
it's the same
on
bodies,
bikes. Though.
It's the same bodies who are doing extra hours, basically. I think that's,
and I think they are trying their best to keep recruiting more guards.
They are, and it's a difficulty.
Do you blame society?
Do I blame society?
No, I'm asking Carl.
I don't get into that, like, society made me do it type stuff. That is a total cop-out. But look, what I will say is this. I operate too...
But hang on. Is it a cop-out?
That society made someone into a criminal? Yeah.
No, that there are circumstances.
There is circumstances, but we see time and again that some
Eddie
people
Mullen
come
said
through.
Yesterday, poverty is the big reason most of the people in Mountjoy have in common poverty.
It certainly does have it in common. A lot of people who turn to crime grow up in one-parent families. They grow up in welfare. There's a host of things. What I'm saying is you do see time and again that people from the same set of circumstances go on and don't become criminals. So is it an indicator or predicator, perhaps? But it is not the fault of society. I operate two offices in the city centre. One is at the junction of Summerhill and the North Circular Road. The other's on Pier Street. If I was to show you the CCTV footage of things that I have seen just around our place, you'd be surprised. I would never call the police I typically wouldn't call the police other than just to make sure it fits the bill for insurance. So the police are ultimately a reactive force. There is no presence on the street that I see, certainly not in the areas that I am in, and they are high crime areas. The other thing I would say is I actually don't know a single guard in any of these areas. So that connection between the community and the police, it's gone. Like, I don't know any of them. I've been on Pier Street for 20 years, you know. I can't tell
you. And you have a big Garda station up the road from you there.
Absolutely, absolutely. But, you know, and working next to Spring Garden Lane, where we had one office for 12 years, which is a huge methadone clinic, you know, I used to see people injecting drugs openly every day for 12 years. I mean, I'm anesthetized to it now. It doesn't even bother me. I just like, okay, mate, sorry, we moved there just when you're finished shooting up. This is the kind of thing where we look at some of the issues around crime, and a lot of it is drugs. And I think that we have not approached things correctly in terms of how to resolve the impact of drugs and how it interplays with society. Like, the prohibition approach clearly isn't working. There is no connection between community and Garda. Within inner city society, I am comfortable in saying that there is also a don't tell pervasive mentality where...
What do you mean?
Everybody sees something happen, but when they go looking for witnesses or statements, suddenly nobody saw anything. And that is, like, why is it there's a... I actually don't know where it comes from, because the people most impacted by this crime are the same people.
We've no evidence that that's very widespread. But look, also, like,
what I'm trying to say is anecdotally, from years in the city centre, I can tell you right now that people say,
people
don't talk to the cops.
Are afraid. Okay. Yeah. So, Kate.
I mean, I would disagree with that. I would have a very strong connection with the Gardaí in my community. And if there's if something goes down, I ring Rathmines and I say, I need you down here now because there's a lad doing whatever. He's got a couple of knives or whatever.
But is there more law and order then in the leafy suburbs than there is in the city
centre? No, I don't believe so, but I do believe there is
policing.
A relationship there. Yeah. And there are relationships in certain areas, maybe not in Pier Street.
I'm not going to get into a derby between Pier Street or North Circular Road and Rathmines, but Rathmines is nice. Like, you're not dealing with the same.
Yeah, but I think it's to make a brushstroke, there's no relationship with the Gardaí. I think around the country in communities, the Gardaí do connect with businesses. But I do think there is a don't tell attitude. I mean, if something goes down and if it doesn't affect your insurance, are you going to report it? Are you going to do your day in court? Are you going to waste all that time and procedure? Could take you maybe 2 weeks of work. You're not going to do it.
Okay,
you're not going to prosecute.
So you're saying the figures for crime could be coming down because nobody's bothering to report a lot of it anymore.
The last thing I'm doing is...
So have you had specific incidents where you didn't bother reporting it?
Of course.
Like what?
Well, I mean, we've had people throw things at us and obviously abuse. We've had to close the doors with lads banging them down. I had a lad in with two knives. The guards couldn't come because he was armed and we had to... make him tea, actually. It was actually how we solved the problem until the guards
tell you we can't come
he's armed, yeah. And I was like, well, neither am I.
So what were they suggesting?
Wait until they have to wait for an armed response
unit.
That's normal.
And yeah, and how long did they suggest to you that was going to take?
Well, about 8 or 10 minutes maybe it took. But that's normal
for an armed
enough.
Response unit.
Yeah, but that's okay. That was during the pandemic. That's a lockdown incident. We'd have stuff all the time happening. Now, obviously,
has it all changed since lockdown?
No.
Did it change the texture of everything though in the city?
I do think the pandemic impacted the way people view life, and I'm very conscious of how it's impacted the younger generation. And I do think there is a breakdown in social cohesion as a result of COVID and the lockdowns. And I do think a particular age group of teenager were affected more than any of the rest of us. And a sort of get out of the house and roam around on your bicycles because we can't have you locked in the bottom of the house anymore.
Gangs of young men, they seem a lot prevalent, a lot more prevalent nowadays in the city. But what I can say, and this is from, you know, time spent around the city centre for a very long, every day, like 12 hours, is that I don't think that they're actually far more prevalent. I think that the dilution factor of how many people are normally in town every day versus the fact that they're there and they live there, that they just seem a lot more obvious. So instead of having 500, you know, Joe citizens and, you know, 10 youths who you might describe whatever means you want, that when that Joe citizen percentage goes down to, you know, 200 people, suddenly they seem a lot more obvious. We've always had young people. We've always had youth gangs.
Okay, but
we've always had all the issues that go with it.
This is interesting. Are there just less people going into town, yeah?
I think that's a factor for definite. And because they're always on the street, they seem a lot more prevalent.
I thought it was very interesting, the Garda Commissioner and his media blitz during the week trumpeted the idea that crime is actually going down, and he produced an array of statistics.
Yeah. And that our levels of crime compared to Dublin... Dublin compared to other cities is technically on paper a much safer place.
Well, way safer. And I'm not convinced of this argument of, you know, that we've had some sort of societal breakdown. You know, I deal with teenagers every day, older teenagers granted, and young adults, and from all
who are in who are in third level education, some who have them, opportunities in life and have a structure around them and are being carried along by a momentum that all of us were probably lucky to be carried on.
As you know, we're based in, you know, we're in Ballymun basically, although our address is really Glasnevin. And we have a huge access programme bringing in students from Coolock and Finglas, Ballymun and others. Not enough in my view, but... Yeah.
They're getting opportunities.
And Gene Kerrigan is a very interesting
piece. Alternatives.
Well, indeed, because we're providing it to him. But Gene Kerrigan has an interesting piece in the back of the Sunday Independent today, making the point that allegations or the assertions that, you know, that society has somehow gone to pot needs to be treated very carefully. And I would agree with it. If you compare our Dublin to some place like, you know, we saw the American Embassy warning tourists, although I was very interested in that vox pop at the Notre Dame game yesterday, and most American tourists said they never felt safer, because if they go to inner city Detroit, Cleveland, Boston, New York, you know, name your city in America, you know, you run the risk of being shot.
Yeah, Ciara.
Anecdotally, from what I have experienced, what I've seen myself as someone who would, you know, go out some weekends, we actually, myself and my friends, don't go into the city centre anymore.
Really?
Yeah. We've made a decision, you know, to stay away for several reasons. You can't get a taxi home, even if there's taxis available outside of some bars and clubs. And actually public transport like the Lewis stops at midnight, and if you are at a late bar trying to get a taxi home, it's impossible. So we've made a decision to stay locally, that you can walk home once there's a group of you. Secondly, people have become extremely aggressive in approaching you on the street. You could be totally on your own with a group of friends chatting, waiting to queue in to somewhere, and you'll be approached in an aggressive nature. And
hang on, no, just to be clear, people looking for money, etc.
People looking for money. Actually, some people as well, you know, for different reasons, drugs related. Also, people approaching you unsolicited,
offering drugs.
Asking for money for drugs, but also of a sexual nature as well. Apart from the clubbing scene during the day in the city centre, I have experienced absolutely a difference in the number of gangs, in particular of young males that are around the city centre. I would.
And you're based around the south side, presumably.
I am, but
as a park car, are you?
Yeah. I obviously my office based in Leinster House, and you would pop out now and again to Zara and H&M and those, and at the weekends as well when you're going shopping into Henry Street in particular. I have definitely noticed an increase in young males in gangs, and only the day before yesterday I was getting off a Lewis stop, and it was 2 p.m. in the day, and there was only one exit to come down, and I had to stand and wait for a couple of minutes until a young male was finished shooting up at the bottom of the stairs, because I was afraid in the pouring rain to go down the steps in case I was going to be approached. I wouldn't have been able to escape, essentially. And actually a number of people waited until this person in broad daylight in front of everyone finished doing what he was doing. So without doubt, there has been a complete difference, an escalation in aggressiveness, groups of young males, and just the feeling of not being safe in the city. And can I just say, the area that I live in Dublin Bay South, people talk about, you know, the city centres, disadvantaged areas. There was a hijacking outside my front door that only happened 2 weeks ago at 8 o'clock in the evening. So it's not just, localised in areas, disadvantaged areas and in the city centre.
Okay. We are being, it's the same as yesterday, we've been deluged with texts here along the lines of bring back Lugs Brannigan, and someone's just back from Spain. Security guards had more kit and apparently more power than our Gardaí. They had long nightsticks, cuffs and pepper spray. As for the Spanish police, big strong men and women in body armour, a pair of boots up to the knees, a gun on their hips. Nobody would mess with them. I never felt safer. Why? Because I'm a law-abiding citizen and they don't bother me and I don't bother them. And look, there were, I think a lot of people were bothered by the notion of armed Gardaí, and I think Irish people do get a shock when they're abroad and they see Gardaí with guns. But look,
But is that what we want? Big security guards on the doors of our major shops armed with kit. I mean, obviously, I think most people would think more Gardaí and a more visible presence to stop, people shooting up in open, to use that phrase, in broad daylight and intimidating people who are going about their daily business. Anyone who gets on the Lewis, you know, you still run the risk of all sorts of people attacking, well, not attacking, but like threatening you, demanding money. I've had it myself, and you know, I can look after myself. But my daughters of a similar age to Keir, they're not great fans of going out at night. They certainly wouldn't go anywhere on their own in the city centre. I mean, it is a visible problem that we do need.
Yeah, and look, I don't want to be talking all this up, but it does sound as if, in general, we could be moving towards that situation where the city centre does get a bit hollowed out. And you see, it happened in the pandemic anyway. I think people started staying more local and everything. So maybe that was
the beginning
of it.
And if you go to the United States, to those cities I mentioned earlier, and you mentioned, they are all hollowed out. There is no inner city in Los Angeles anymore, in Chicago, in Detroit, places I've spent lots of time myself.
San Francisco.
They're all out in the suburbs.
Look, I'm from Los Angeles. I lived in Chicago many years, both times in the city. They're great cities. Dublin is a great city. The city centre, by the way, yes, it does have problems, but I do want to advocate on behalf of the city centre. There are also great communities, multi-generational communities. Mm-hmm. When I walk down Pier Street, every business that's been there for any amount of time, I know the people in there. We all talk to each other. We chat. There's so many good things about the city centre. So I don't think at risk of being hollowed out, what I'd be saying is there is, obvious issues, and they've actually been there forever, but they're the, you know, topic du jour now. And they need to be addressed. And those issues are community policing, some ability to get the kids in those areas working rather than hanging out in street corners, whatever programs are required to enable those things. And I don't mean education, I mean just get jobs. And the third thing then is I actually forgot what the third thing was. But
okay, that's all right. All right, we'll take a break. Ciara Phelan, Kate O'Connell, Carl Dieter and Professor Gary Murphy staying with us.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Ciara Phelan, Kate O'Connell, Carl Dieter and Gary Murphy are still with us. And guys, there's a lot more things I want to get to, so we might start moving along through things a bit now. Ciara, Before we get to the front page of the Business Post on property, you picked a piece in the Sunday Independent by Wayne O'Connor. This is based on the Irish auctioneers and valuers do their regular survey.
Yeah.
Price of a house up 25% since the coalition took office.
Yeah, it details basically that it costs nearly €330,000 on average to buy a home now, and they point to this has been an increase of more than 66,000 since the coalition came in of the summer 2020, and the prices is up by an extra €90,000 on average to buy a home since 2017. This coupled obviously with mortgage interest rate hikes, with repayments unaffordable for homeowners, and it's coupled with, like I said, the Business Post front page. And it just kind of further exposes the situation that the government is finding themselves in as discussions are coming along about the budget.
So what are they going to do?
So we definitely know that there's going to be an increase, as Darragh O'Brien has indicated, about the rent credit for renters. He's been adamant, and numerous cabinet ministers have said that something will have to change for landlords to ensure that they stay in the market. Darragh O'Brien has discussed that in the Sunday Business Post this week.
Now, there seems to be some kind of disagreement over whether there'd be conditionality attached to it, that they would have to stay in the market for a while to get these credits, the landlords.
Yeah, so following the interview by Michael Brennan, it does seem like the spokesperson for the housing minister issued a clarification in terms of that, you know, when he was speaking about conditions around it, that it means that they haven't been fully nailed down yet.
Okay.
However, that has been the proposal for a long time now, that if you're going to give a tax break to landlords, there has to be greater security for renters in terms of whether they are going to have to give a commitment to stay in the market for maybe 5 to 10 years to ensure that supply stays there, that they're not just getting this tax break.
We're thinking one way or another that small private landlords are going to get something in this budget, aren't they?
Okay. Yeah, that's,
and is there going to be some mortgage interest relief for homeowners?
It's not nailed down yet. There's calls on it from the opposition parties. There's some cabinet ministers who are in favour of it, but there's also a fear about the cost of it and inflation, and then essentially how do you wind it down? So it's not totally nailed down yet in terms of mortgage interest relief, but that seems to be, for a lot of the cabinet ministers, they feel like helping that squeeze middle, it's something that they need to tackle to ensure that there's support there given to the homeowners. And I mean, look, before I go into criticism about what has happened with the government, you have to see what's happening with the housing crisis. You have to note that there has been, you know, obviously commencements are up, there has been an increase in first time buyers, but the pace of home building is just not meeting the level of homelessness that we're seeing with record levels.
Figures up again.
You know, the Eurostat report only out 2 weeks ago showing on average Irish young couples are living at home with their parents more than anyone else in the EU. And, you know, obviously we're very much aware of the supply issues that the country is facing. And that's only going to be exacerbated now when we see the amount of students that are going to get their CAO points next Wednesday. They'll have to defer them for a year because they can't find accommodation in the capital.
Carl, this is your area. What's the answer?
Well, look, there's a lot of bright people working in this space. And, you know, so I just want to say that I'm not like some special knowledge base that has the answer. What I do know and can say is it's...
So at the moment, it seems to involve, as I was saying at the start, giving every party to this money, government money.
Yeah. Yeah? Well, let's just break down what the government actually do. All right, we can say they provide health, they do all these other, really at their nub, they take money from A and they give to B, and they wrap it around these different rules and ways of doing it, and they're described as policies. That is the ultimate foundation of government, is a redistribution tool by and large. Now there's some things like military, etc., and that's taking money from A, the population, to give to B, the army, in order to provide security services. So because that's the only tool they have ultimately, then that's the tool they have to use. And so it has to be something financial, because they can't turn around and say, we're going to resolve this by creating a house out of thin air with a crew of builders that we don't have. Or if, even if you did have them, they can't do it any quicker than anyone else. And in fact, they usually do it at a higher cost, as the evidence has shown. So
are you surprised, by the way, just before you continue there, are you surprised that even if you offer a developer €150,000, like €150,000 into his arse pocket and say, here, build an apartment, sell it for whatever you can get for it. We'll give you 150 grand as well. That it still doesn't seem to be attractive to a lot of developers to do that. The building prices and the costs are so out of whack.
Yeah.
And are the prices.
I have a fairly astute faith in the greed of developers. So I do believe that that is naturally one of their driving forces. And so they don't walk away from 150,000 of free money lightly. So I suspect that that must be true. Otherwise, they just fill their boots.
So, like, how is anyone without the 150 grand even thinking of building an apartment? So, given that...
There's a few things. So what they're talking about is apartments for sale. So the people who are building apartments, by and large, tend to be large funds who can let something play out over 25, 30 years. It tends to come.
Okay, so that's not a real price they'll pay. It's a notional price.
They're willing to accept these. They're doing all of their calculations.
So they'll overpay for everything, basically, compared to what people in the real market.
Because over 30 years, it'll all work out. The other one would be approved housing bodies are also very active in that space, and they can afford to do things at prices that don't make sense for those who are pure
profit-driven.
Yeah, I saw
the head of the Limerick Chamber of Commerce was saying that out of every 10 houses built in Limerick now, only 4 of them are actually going to first-time buyers, and it's mainly approved housing bodies buying.
So what you
again, we want that. We want
But you see, you say you want it, but as opposed to what? Like, so we are getting those things. So it's not like we're not getting any apartments or any houses. Our housing target is being hit in a lot of different metrics. But what we're talking about now is specifically landlords who saying, please don't leave the market, even though we know that they were leaving for years. We're saying now is please don't leave now. So it's like a day late and a dollar short with that big finding. And then we're also saying that we need houses for people to build. And yet some of the biggest purveyors of housing aren't in the for sale market. So this is where it gets into this very difficult area that I don't believe anyone truly understands of how do you strike a balance between taxation, in particular taxation of the housing stock that is there, the sites that are out there that, you know, say developers don't want to have to pay levies on. How do we join up import taxes, VAT, supply of labor, getting enough people into skilled trades so that we have the number of bodies in there to provide this work? And that's the thing that you're not going to fix with whatever the Sunday Business headline says. I mean, that, you know, it's a good piece. And I think O'Brien is, like, he does get it. He is trying to fix the thing. He's not a nefarious character by any means. But you can't resolve it fast, and you can't always resolve it with just using money as the tool. And those other policy pieces are so slow that no one wants to hear about it. They want budget. They want the crack pipe. They want, boom, instant hits. It doesn't work that way. Kate, and so it's going to trudge and trudge.
As a former and maybe future politician, do you have any insights on this?
Well, I think it all feeds into the same argument. If you have homelessness and you have children brought up in a fractured situation where they don't have any base, as it were, then you have a level of hopelessness creeps in, parents not able to provide, marital breakdown. It all, having no home in your childhood and while you're in secondary school, it leads to a very fragmented life. Yeah. And
but
all
of
the research done...
But short of having a time machine to go back, we know all that. Short of having a time machine to go back and start building houses 10 years earlier than we did, or resume building houses 10 years earlier than we did, we are where we are now. And it does seem as if it's kind of an impossible problem. You can keep moving money around between all the stakeholders, but if there aren't enough houses,
there's not
built,
enough houses, but I think the skills
to build them.
The skills shortage is a huge issue, and the price of labour. And then, I mean, it's not an area of any expertise in, but in terms of building standards, I'm not suggesting we drop our building standards, but if they're able to build things on the continent with less windows or different orientations, there are perhaps, or a little bit maybe overindulgent in some ways when it comes to...
Are you suggesting that maybe everyone doesn't need a 2 en suites in
exactly,
their house?
Exactly, I think. And there was an article a couple of months ago about the price of building X here and on the continent, and our standards in terms of requiring additional things like en suites for every room and everything.
And look, the much maligned Conor Skehan has this idea he punts every now and again, which is that we need a Ryanair for building who buy things at mass scale. So they have economies of scale. They build simple houses with 20-30%, I think, planning permission to extend by 20-30% automatically there. You don't put in a fancy kitchen. You don't put in fancy toilets. people move into basic houses, and then as you move on in life, as you maybe make more money or whatever, you start adding to it. But I think, look,
so it's a help onto the ladder,
Connor
essentially.
Does drives
and you want
nuts.
To make sure those houses are well built in the first place.
Yes. I mean,
the
but, state, a good basic house.
I mean, because the state has built houses before. I mean, built them in the 30s when we had very little money. It built them in the 50s when we had little money. And then there was a policy decision to stop building them. And I think, to be fair, most people do accept, except perhaps those on the hard left, that the government is trying things. But, you know, when you just read that article in the Business Post, then this line pops out. The state subsidies are not sufficient, the developers say, to bridge the gap between what it costs to build an apartment and the sale price achievable. And then you see that no matter how much money the government throws at it, and we saw the homeless numbers up again this week, that I'm afraid most people have their minds made up that maybe it's time to give someone else a chance politically. And I think that's what Dara O'Brien is fighting. I was interested by this thing about the backstop, just to finish, of the state buying up any apartments developers cannot sell on the open market and using them for cost rental housing. You know, it's an argument I think that should certainly be looked at, because we have to house our people. Well, Carr talked about the state. I mean, one of the jobs of the state is to make sure its people are housed.
Okay, and we will come back to that again and again and again. RTE, Carl, you picked the Business Post, Michael Brennan and Conal Thomas. Fears RTE bailout will rise to 35 million. There are various figures flying around today for the RTE bailout. What are your observations?
Well, there's a figure from Michael Brennan and Conal Thomas in the Sunday Business Post saying 35 million. Hugh O'Connell in the Sunday Independent is saying it'll be 50 million. So
yeah, no, 50 million, that seems to be a speculative figure. It hasn't been mentioned by the government or RTE or anyone.
But they are fantastic, huge numbers. And I think that it just really, the whole culmination of all of this, I think, from looking at what happened over the summer, was that things were being done really to prevent the rank and file staff maybe from getting a raise. And so like certain groups were getting, you know, preferential treatment and things that drove everyone crazy. There is a need, I think, for RTE to simplify its operations. I mean, when you talk about, say, public service broadcast, I don't actually have a clear idea of what that is. I mean, theoretically, we could probably get world news from Euronews and BBC. I think local news would have to stay here. I think Irish cultural things would have to be made here. You know, but there's a lot that RTE does that I don't actually know truly what the full definition of public broadcast service is.
Well, entertainment does seem to be included in that definition. So
okay, entertainment from where? I mean, or how much of it has to be from here versus elsewhere? And I think if you're talking about big numbers that have to be justified and continued into the future to make sure that whatever you have, like that has to be really well thought out. And when you look at the existing structure, I mean, there's a number of staff grades, 164 staff grades. I mean, someone here somewhere is a specialist in just knowing those 164 grades. Or does anyone?
And probably then, you know, in the department. I presume like most big state bureaucracies that things get layered on top of other things nothing gets got rid of, more grades get added in.
I know from working in the mortgage industry and advising people that like RT staff are paid quite well compared to the staff in other media organisations, and there tends to be more of them. And so I'm just saying, to put out quality work, and they do, I've no issue with that, but other places do as well. NPR radio probably wouldn't have as many people working on a show as you would have in an RTE radio.
Well, we don't know that.
No, pardon?
We don't know.
I haven't compared every show, but I've been like an NPR. I've seen what they do and the size of the team. So, and I've been in other stations as well and seen the size of their teams. And like I said, from doing mortgages, you see what people earn. So I think there is a need, you know, maybe to reduce the staff size, but get the people who do remain and reward them better. But like have a concentration of skills that warrants putting this money in so that you have something that's viable, sustainable, and keeps the quality of what national broadcast is.
And why should we reduce the staff size? I mean, why can't we make sure that the staff who are here and looking for mortgages and, we relocate them? Or, I mean, I'm not convinced of this idea that we should just buy in the news from the BBC or ITN or NPR or anywhere else. I mean, one of the great strengths of RTE and, you know, and media is changing unquestionably. And this is half the problem with the licence fee, is that, you know, people under 24 don't watch television, or if they do, they're watching streaming and they're watching it on an iPad or whatever. But RTE has a very important role to play in the public life of the nation, as we've seen over the coverage of events of RT itself, but of, you know, everything else that goes on in our country and beyond. And I'm not convinced of this idea that, you know, we should, if it's global, we should leave someone else tell us what it's about.
Yeah. Kate?
Yeah, I agree. I think public service broadcasting is very important, and I think RT very much stepped up to the plate during COVID, you know, really produced top quality, fact-based information, and I imagine the figures for people tuning in to RTE radio and television during that time were very, very high.
And they remain very high in a lot of cases.
Yeah, they do. Yeah, and I mean, yeah. I'm a dedicated, organise my day around Radio 1 sort of a person, but I'm much probably in the minority now. But in terms of the bailout amount, the 35 million, I think the amount, the barter account money was heading up on 8. You're looking at like 20% of the bailout amount being spent
now,
on.
Now, just to be clear, I'm not going to remotely get into defending RT here. Right?
Oh, absolutely.
I'm not. But just let me say one thing, which I think is an important point. 8 million came in on the barter account, right? 1.2 or 1.4 was spent from the barter account on the kind of discretionary items, the flip-flops, et cetera, and I'm sure a lot of other legitimate expenditure on bringing in advertising.
Of course.
But like the 8 million figure does not represent what people were...
But they're easy things to forgetting the details. You know, they're easy things to go, oh, well, it's, you know...
Yeah,
the,
but
the
that 8 million was money that came into RT 100%. From the barter account. Do you understand? I do understand.
Yeah. But what I'm saying is a lot of the stuff that's gone on is very easy to portray as all bad when, as you've rightly said, it's actually, you know, only a small portion of it. And it's very hard to go back to the taxpayer and say, you know, pay your licence fee and the governance be right. I think a line has to be drawn in the sand with regard to RT and to move on from the past and the governance structures to the future to be impenetrable and to be very, very clear.
Yeah, Ciara.
Just in terms of the barter account, just to remind people, it was over a period of 5 years, 1.2 million euros, a lot of money. So it is in terms of what it was spent on, the outrageous things that we've all heard of. And I think the interim Mazars report only creates further questions for RTE in terms of, you know, the lack of oversight, the number of people and the names who had access to it. There was no threshold on the value of purchases. You know, as someone put it at the conference to Minister Catherine Martin, you know, a lot of people were taken for a ride here in terms of the money that was spent on not only staff, but the taxpayer as well. I think what will be really interesting in the coming weeks is the cost-cutting measures that the Director General, Kevin Backhurst, is going to put forward to the government, because, you know, a lot of cabinet ministers are adamant, you know, it's very politically sensitive as well in terms of how much money it's going to be, the RTE is going to be given. And I think the cost cutting measures, and we've seen some of them filter through the paper, such as, you know, the cut in the pay grades. He did signal out he had begun discussing presenters' pay with some presenters. When he was asked about their reaction, he said it varies, and the presenter that he was speaking to, you know, he said, at the moment, we're not looking at compulsory redundancies, but he didn't rule it out down the line. And, you know, another element he said he was looking at was the gender balance at RTE. Now, it's not a cost-cutting measure, but I think, you know, he has a lot to prove here in terms of what he's going to do to ensure the cuts actually happen. And from speaking to ministers, they're saying unless there's something substantial putting forward to them, that it needs to happen for them to be able to hand over a significant amount of taxpayer money.
I mean, I think there are two issues. One, I think everyone knows the licence fee is a bit of a busted flush and certainly needs a complete restructuring. If nothing else good comes from this whole saga, it's that the government takes a hold of the licence fee issue and restructures it. Because it's not fair to Carl's point in terms of other media organisations, which a lot of people get their news and current affairs and sport from. And secondly is that, you know, it is a sorry story for RTE itself, the lack of oversight, the lack of structures to make sure this didn't happen. I just think in the rewriting of RTE histories over the next couple of decades, this will be a sad, sorry chapter.
So there's been a lot of attempted watersheds maybe during the year, but this could be the actual watershed. Mm. Okay, we'll take a break here. Feeling Kate O'Connell, Carl Dieter and Gary Murphy staying with us.
Text 51551. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Okay, welcome back. Ciara Phelan, Kate O'Connell, Carl Dieter and Gary Murphy still with us. Ciara Phelan, tell us about Brotox, which is in the Sunday Times today. Brotox is on the increase.
Yeah, for men. So the report highlights that, you know, there's an issue with one clinic, two clinics in Dublin and across the country. And they're saying that they're seeing an increase in the number of men coming in for Botox. They're asking to look younger, fresher, more awake, and they want a natural, subtle way of appearing younger. And one beauty salon says that 20% of their clients are men, and this has doubled in the past 3 years.
It does seem to be, particularly among the younger cohort, is it, like, you know, we used to think it was for people who were getting older, but now there seems to be this notion of preventative.
Yeah. It's this thing called baby Botox that a lot of people get sucked in on. You're pointing to me here.
I don't want to shake you, but I have had a bit. And you're happy to?
Absolutely. And I think there was a stigma associated with it a long time ago. As he lowers the glasses on his nose to see if I've any movement in my face anymore. Yes, I do.
You're fresh.
Thank you. I'm actually due a top up now at the moment. But
how often is a top up?
Oh, I think I only get it once a year, and it's basically my forehead. I used to hate some of the lines of my forehead, the resting angry face, some people might say that you sometimes have a Brendan as well.
I actually get a lot of work done to keep this resting angry face looking as angry and restful. Presumably you're not an outlier among your peers.
No, absolutely not. And, you know, men in particular, I'm aware of men in their late 30s and early 40s. One or two definitely in Leinster House that I'd be aware of that gets a bit of Brotox.
Really? On which side of the estate are we talking about?
Couldn't possibly say. Okay. I will keep those sources safe. It's definitely
an increase. Is it people who are appearing on screen, which you would be aware of as well?
Not particularly. No, I think people just take more pride in their appearance, and they want to appear fresher. And yeah, I don't think there's that stigma associated with it anymore that maybe there was 10, 15 years ago. Yeah. And there's a reason why it's booming. We see, cosmetic shops opening across the country, and the Mayo plant, I think they sold like over €1 billion was the latest figures earlier this year in terms of Botox that they were exporting.
It's become the new manicure. Mm. It's really? That common.
Are you doling it out in the chemists?
No, we're not doling it out.
Chemists are kind of doing it, some of them.
No,
are
we're
they?
Not. We're not. So only anyone, we're licensed to inject vaccines, but not Botox. Dentists and doctors are the experts in this area. But there are illegal places throwing stuff into people with no qualifications. But the idea is that the baby Botox is that you start it. I've had none of it, clearly, like yourself, Brendan. But the baby Botox is that you prevent the wrinkles starting in the first place. Now, I would always question, when do you stop? And you stop at 70 and just let it all fall down. So I think I'd be very interested to see, you know, what way people are in maybe 30 years' time. You know, at what point do you give it up?
I wouldn't mind giving it up now because I have noticed a reduction in the lines. So there you go.
So it wears off.
You think even without it? Yeah?
Pardon?
Even without it, you're saying if you gave it up now?
Yeah. You've noticed a reduction. So
hence you think
why
the preventative did work?
Absolutely.
Because you freeze your face, so you can't actually move your forehead.
I just blistered my face. Is that frozen?
I would like to say that, Ciara's looking very, very expressive today altogether, as indeed were you all. So thank you very much. I'm so upset that we ran out of time just when we were talking about the real stuff. But anyway,
the school books with the price of Botox.
Ciara Phelan, political correspondent with the Irish Examiner. Kate O'Connell, pharmacist and former Fine Gael TD. Carl Dieter, financial analyst. And Professor Gary Murphy of the School of Law and Government at DCU. Thank you all very much. And now it's 12 o'clock and we'll go to Kate Egan in the newsroom.